I leave every show knowing more about something than I did before, and that something could be any number of topics, because the show covers everything that I didn't know I needed to know.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to comedian Tig Notaro, and I'll also sit down with musician and author John Darnielle on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
On the next Backstory, in 19th century advertisements, railroad companies promised European immigrants a land of plenty. The American West, they said, was the ideal place to be a successful farmer.
In a way, it's a sort of monstrous and ludicrous lie when you think about the reality of it. But it's how the West was, in fact, sold to these people.
A History of the American Farmer, next time on Backstory.
Backstory, Monday at noon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. You can hear Bullseye at 4 p.m. on Sunday. To the best of our knowledge, 8 a.m. Sunday morning here on local public radio. The time is 10 o'clock.
Last week, Turkey experienced its worst terror attack ever. Two suicide bombers killed over 100 people at a peace rally in Ankara. Minutes after the blasts, social media was flooded with images of people laying in pools of blood. We will discuss media coverage. And on the domestic front, California Governor Jerry Brown signed hundreds of bills affecting a wide range of issues, including the right to die, renewable energy, voting, sex education, guns, privacy, equal pay for women, and protections for foster children. With fewer reporters in Sacramento, how are citizens learning about these new laws? Join us after the news.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard with the BBC News. Hungary has announced that it will seal its border with Croatia from midnight local time to stem the flow of migrants trying to cross to Western Europe. The Foreign Minister, Peter Szijjártó, said a meeting of EU leaders on Thursday had failed to agree with Hungary's proposal for the creation of a common EU border force, and his country had to take unilateral action as a result. Nick Thorpe reports from Budapest.
5,000 to 8,000 asylum seekers and migrants currently cross Hungary from Croatia to Austria each day. Refugees will still be able to apply for asylum at two so-called transit zones on the border, the foreign minister said. But almost all such applications will be rejected automatically on the grounds that migrants have already crossed countries which Hungary regards as safe.
Turkey has said that the European Union's offer of financial help to ease the migrant crisis is unacceptable. A package of measures was agreed by EU leaders on Thursday, but the Turkish foreign minister said the amount offered was insignificant and meaningless. Syrian government forces backed by Russian air power and allied militias have opened a new front against rebel fighters south of Aleppo, Syria's largest city. Control of Aleppo is divided between the Syrian government, insurgent groups fighting President Bashar al-Assad, and Islamic State militants. More from Jim Muir.
According to the rebels who posted this footage on the internet, Russian airstrikes on the countryside south of Aleppo began in the middle of the night to soften up rebel positions for a dawn offensive by Syrian army troops backed by militias and other supporters. This was the latest of at least four offensives launched by regime forces with Russian air support in the past 2 weeks. They're in a wide stretch of territory, most of it rural, in the areas north of the cities of Homs and Hama, and in the rugged northern parts of Latakia province along the coast.
The United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has strongly condemned a Palestinian arson attack on a Jewish shrine near the town of Nablus. In a statement at the start of an emergency Security Council meeting on the escalating violence between Israelis and the Palestinians, Mr. Ban called for those behind what he called a reprehensible attack to be brought to justice. The United States has condemned a recent missile test by Iran as a clear violation of UN sanctions. More from our defense correspondent, Jonathan Marcus.
After reviewing the available information, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, says that the October 10 test was of a medium-range ballistic missile inherently capable of delivering a nuclear weapon. This, the Americans say, was a clear violation of a U.N. Security Council resolution dating back to 2010, which prohibits Iran from testing this category of missile. The launch may also be against the spirit of continuing restrictions contained in the deal reached between Iran and the major powers over its wider nuclear activities.
World News from the BBC. The government of Chad says that almost 60 women wearing full-face veils have been arrested since a triple suicide bomb attack on Saturday. Nathalie Magnan reports from N'Djamena.
The Minister of Public Security, Hamad Mahamat Bashir, has made a strong statement before the media, making what he calls a last warning to those still ignoring the government's ban on burqas. He insisted that the measure applies to everywhere in the country and that security forces will consider all those who don't respect it as terrorists. The ban has been announced in June after the first attack on Chadian soil claimed by Boko Haram.
The construction of what's expected to be the biggest port in East Africa has started in Tanzania. The transport hub in Bagamoyo will handle 20 million containers each year, twice the current capacity of the port in the biggest city, Dar es Salaam. The European and Russian space agencies are to send a landing craft to the moon to determine the feasibility of setting up a permanent human settlement. The unmanned mission called Luna 27 is due to launch in 5 years' time. If resources are plentiful, it could clear the way for the return of humans to the moon. Sepp Blatter, the suspended president of football's world governing body FIFA, has insisted a $2 million payment he made to the head of European football, Michel Platini, was entirely legal. Mr. Blatter was giving his first interview since being removed from office last week.
I had a contract with Michel Platini, a gentleman's agreement, and that was implemented. But I cannot give any details on the agreement, because this is now being looked at by two committees. Everything in the agreement abided by the law. At some stage, the suspension will expire. Until then, the committees will investigate. But I don't think they will come to a quick conclusion.
The two men have been suspended by FIFA for 90 days, while Swiss investigators look into corruption allegations. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Saturday, Turkey was hit with its worst terror attack ever. Two suicide bombers killed over 100 people just minutes after thousands were preparing for a peace rally in Ankara. Following the attack, there's been several large-scale protests against the Turkish government. Joining us to talk about media coverage is Noah Blazer, an independent journalist who has been based in Istanbul since 2011. Hi, Noah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
It's good to have you. And on the domestic front, California Governor Jerry Brown has signed hundreds of bills affecting a wide range of issues, including the right to die, renewable energy, voting, sex education, guns, privacy, equal pay for women, and protections for foster children, just to name a few. With fewer reporters in Sacramento, how are citizens learning about these new laws? Today we're joined by Brian Lubitz, editor of Calitix.com, California's progressive news blog. Hi, Brian. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by Karen DeSaw, an award-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Last year, the San Jose Merc published a multi-part series on the alarming use of psychotropic medications among youth in California's foster care system. Karen DeSaw reports that with alarming frequency, foster and health care providers are turning to a risky but convenient remedy to control the behavior of thousands of troubled kids, numbing them with psychiatric drugs that are untested on and often not approved for children. The series got a lot of attention in Sacramento, and Governor Brown has since signed legislation to prevent the overprescription of these drugs. Altogether, he signed three bills this term affecting foster children. And Karen DeSaw joins me in studio. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Brian Lubitz, editor of Calitix.com, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I read an article on The Guardian's website by Ryan Felton about Catholic hospitals, which has sort of been a story that's been going around social media recently, about Catholic hospitals in Michigan denying a tubal ligation to a woman who needed it for health reasons because the American Conference of Bishops has directed that they do not do that procedure anymore.
And
sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
So it was a situation where she was required to have a C-section, and if she were to get pregnant again, it could be life-threatening. So the bishop stepped in the Catholic hospitals, who are now an increasingly large share of hospitals, and especially in rural regions where there's few options, are now denying care to women.
And so they stepped in. So what's going to happen with this woman?
The ACLU filed suit against the hospital, but I believe what happened is that she went to a different hospital, you know, a distance of much further away from her home.
Okay, and we talked with a reporter from RH Reality Check a couple of weeks ago about the highly edited Planned Parenthood videos. And during that show, we talked about a piece that she recently wrote, reporting that by the close of 2011, 1 in 9 hospital beds in this country existed in a Catholic or Catholic-sponsored healthcare facility. And we'll put links to that at yourcallradio.org. So kudos to The Guardian, and thank you for that piece, Brian. What about you, Karen? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I actually listened to an interview just now with reporters from The Intercept and Jeremy Scahill about the release and exposure of what they're calling the drone papers. This is a pretty shocking kind of Edward Snowden-like set of information from a whistleblower showing that 90% of the targets of drone strikes are not the intended targets. And just the whole, what do they call, something like the death chain of command. It was pretty alarming to learn about how this secretive war is taking place and with what such shocking effects on civilians.
I heard part of that. Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept was on Democracy Now! This morning, and the documents were leaked to The Intercept by an unnamed U.S. intelligence source who says he wanted to alert Americans. And in the piece, they report, according to these documents, that during 1 5-month period of an operation in Afghanistan, 9 out of 10 casualties were not the intended target. And we are going to cover this next week. So thank you for bringing that up, Karen.
Thank you.
And what about you, Noah? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, the Wall Street Journal had an absolutely fantastic feature about a 2013 hostage crisis in southern Texas, the hostage crisis of Jimmie Lee Dyke. And it was a wonderful interactive piece that followed this sort of 7-day negotiation with a man who took a 5-year-old boy hostage inside of an underground bunker. And it was very marvelous in the way that it tracked the extensive negotiations that went on, and at the same time the very controversial conclusion, which was the bloody raid of this underground bunker and the violent result.
Why did he take the 5-year-old hostage?
Well, he was a mentally disturbed man, and he claimed that he wanted to broadcast a message to the world, and so he told FBI investigators that he would not harm the boy if he were allowed to tell the media his sort of theory about several conspiracy theories about the government. And I think the most controversial and really the very nuanced part of the piece was that they brought in his daughter to sort of try to calm him down and to get him to trust authorities. But at the very moment when they sort of began this promise to allow and him to talk to his daughter, they then raided the compound while he was emotionally overcome, and they killed him, and they risked the life of this 5-year-old boy. And it was a very wonderful, very in-depth look at how difficult I think FBI hostage crises are, but how controversial often the outcome is.
Wow. So kudos to the Wall Street Journal for that story. And that is Noah Blazer. He's an independent journalist who has been based in Istanbul since 2011. Karen DeSaw is an award-winning investigative reporter with the San Jose Mercury News. And Brian Lubitz is editor of Calatix.com, California's progressive news blog. And we will put links to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. Noah, let's dive in and talk about last week's bombings at a train station in Ankara. The bombings happened when thousands of people were getting ready for a peace rally. And minutes after the blasts, social media, especially Twitter, was completely overwhelmed with images of the explosion site and people laying in pools of blood. Can you give us a little bit of background here? Who called for this peace rally and who was there? How many people were expected to take part?
Yeah, sure. Well, this has been an absolutely traumatic week in Turkish history. And the background of this march was, as well, a rather tragic set of events in Turkey. Earlier this summer, a bomber linked to the Islamic State carried out a separate suicide bombing in a southern border town in Turkey, next to the Syrian border. And he killed several Turkish activists. And unfortunately, that seemed to trigger a long series of civil conflicts inside of Turkey. Most notably, it reignited Kurdish anger against the Turkish government and Kurdish insurgents that blamed the Turkish government for security lapses in that attack broke a two-year ceasefire and began a very, very bloody string of attacks throughout the country. In that context, thousands of demonstrators, including Kurdish demonstrators, joined this march on Saturday last week. And as those tens of thousands of people were gathering for this march, the Islamic State struck yet again and killed. Now the death count is currently at about 102 people.
102, because there's been confusion about how many people died and how many people were injured.
That's absolutely correct. And unfortunately, the confusion and the massive amount of public anger over this attack has really been exaggerated by the government's very swift, first of all, it's blocked the social media after the attack. Social media basically shut down inside of Turkey. And after that, there was a court-ordered media ban, which currently forbids any newspapers or television channels to broadcast any events or updates related to the attack.
And so the Turkish government is attempting to silence journalists, and the Turkish government cut off access to Twitter and other social media platforms?
That's correct. Now, they didn't exactly ban Twitter with a court order, but they limited the bandwidth that an individual can use to access Twitter. So inside of Turkey, it would take minutes to get updates on social media. Now, of course, the most important thing is this gag rule that's been placed on media. Opposition outlets have been very critical of the government in its lax treatment of the Islamic State. For years, Turkey has had an open border policy with Syria, where it's encouraged refugees to come across to seek shelter, which is certainly a very commendable thing. There are currently 2 million refugees inside of Turkey. But unfortunately, because of its opposition to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, for many years it allowed jihadist militants to cross the border freely. And the consequence of that now has been that there's an established presence of groups like the Islamic State inside of Turkey. And unfortunately, on Saturday, we saw the consequence of that. People are very, very angry.
Yesterday, the Hurriyet daily paper reported that an Ankara court issued a sweeping media ban, as you just said, including all kinds of news, interviews, criticism, and similar publications in print, visual, social media, and all kinds of media on the internet covering the blast investigation. Media outlets in the country have officially been notified of the ruling, which brings in one of Turkey's most draconian recent media bans and is effective immediately. So how are Turkish media reacting to these orders?
Well, unfortunately, this is a tired strategy of the government in Turkey. In numerous controversial cases in the past, Turkey has imposed blanket media bans on the country's various news outlets. Unfortunately, this media ban has not caused as much controversy in Turkey because over the past 2 years, there have been hundreds of firings by Reporters Without Borders estimates. There have been over 200 firings of independent journalists in various mainstream media outlets. And that purge of journalists has also been accompanied by an unprecedented number of court cases opened against the country's most fierce and independent journalists. So unfortunately, this media ban comes in the context of a broader crackdown against independent voices. So currently there are several papers that are printing news about the attacks in defiance of the government ban, but they're almost certain to see very harsh fines. And at the same time, the broad-based criticism of government security oversights that one would expect given the circumstances will certainly not happen in Turkey right now, because the media has for so many years been limited by the government very effectively.
Noah, you're an independent journalist who's been in Istanbul since 2011. Do most Western outlets have a bureau in Istanbul? Because the coverage of this bombing has really died down in the U.S.
Well, yes, unfortunately it has. And I think that a lot of that is because of confusion about the exact nature of the attack and the sort of murky implications for Turkey's domestic audience. But I think that the international media has actually done a very good job. The Wall Street Journal has about four correspondents that are dedicated to Turkey. They're based in Turkey. The New York Times has two. The Financial Times has several people here. There's a tremendous amount of media interest in what's happening in Turkey internationally. But as you said, I mean, the problem, I think, is fatigue. And people are very eager to say that Turkey is a divided country, that it's sort of the gatekeeper for Europe, in the sense that it sort of separates the West from the tremendous security issues that are happening in the Middle East right now. And it's a buffer for those millions of refugees who are fleeing from Syria. But at the same time,
Go ahead.
Well, I guess my point here is that although there's a tremendous amount of interest in, you know, what Turkey's position is, I think that, you know, there certainly is a lack of context about what's happening with these bombings. Unfortunately, most of my friends here in Turkey are very concerned that this civil conflict is only going to continue to grow. And I think that the limited international media attention that has sort of followed the bombing has sort of denied international viewers that perspective, that Turkey is actually headed towards possibly more attacks of this nature and an even more divided future.
Well, Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Noah Blazer is an independent journalist who has been based in Istanbul since 2011. We've been talking with him about media coverage of the blasts in Turkey that took place last weekend. According to reports, it was the worst terror attack in Turkey ever. And you can find Noah's reporting at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour, two reporters, Karen DeSaw, an award-winning investigative reporter with the San Jose Mercury News, and Brian Lubitz, editor of Calitix.com, California's progressive blog. And let's now talk about media coverage of the hundreds of bills that California Governor Jerry Brown signed. He signed so many important bills. And a very basic question to both of you. At a time when reporting is really shrinking, we don't have as many reporters in Sacramento as we did, say, 5 years ago, how are citizens supposed to keep up with this? I mean, I had a hard time even just finding a story that included a lot of the bills in just, you know, one nice story. I mean, I had to kind of read separate stories to read about the different bills. Brian, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a good thing, first of all, that the first part is that we have done, there's been so much progressive legislation passed this cycle that it's hard to distill that into one really good piece of journalism, because it would be a book rather than a paragraph.
Because he signed hundreds of bills.
Right, he did. He signed some really great legislation. And, you know, he also vetoed some really great legislation as well, to be fair. But, you know, I think, you know, the same problem that I've been looking at for 10 years now is a lack of coverage of state politics and state policy, because there's always that, you know, there's always a focus on your local pothole, you know, governance, and there's also the focus on, you know, the horse race of who's going to be president, and that state government always, you know, falls in that hole that we have so much difficulty getting coverage on. But, you know, we have some really great legislation, you know. For me, the thing which I always love to point out now is the new Motor Voter Act, which I think is a great move forward in terms of voter registration. But there's also a number of excellent legislation this year.
Yeah, and the motor voter, let's just talk about this one because this is really important. AB 1461 requires California drivers who are eligible to vote to be signed up automatically when they get a new license. And this could really grow the state's voter rolls because 6.6 million Californians who are eligible but not yet registered to vote. 6.6 million, that is a lot of people. I mean, that if those people actually voted, they could completely change California politics.
Well, you know, first of all, I think from a technological perspective, there really is no reason in 2015 that we have to have a voter registration system. Other states have same-day registration, which we should be able to do. We're the home of innovation. There's no reason why we shouldn't have that. But that being said, until we can get to either an elimination of the voter registration system or same-day registration, you know, this is a great step forward towards either of those options. What it does is, if anytime you go into DMV, you have to opt out of voter registration rather than opt in. And, you know, as anybody who has gone through, you know, signing up for any service online where you have to opt out of getting those spam emails, it's much easier to be already opted in with having to opt out. So this is a great move forward.
Right. And voting rights activists say that when people go to the DMV, they're often not even told that they can register to vote. So this is a big one, especially at a time when so many other states are trying to limit voting. And Karen, we're going to talk about your piece in a minute, which resulted in three new bills that protect foster children. But what are your thoughts just overall in terms of the fact that there aren't as many reporters in Sacramento, and it's hard for people to really get this information unless they specifically look for it?
Right. Well, I think the point was well taken that we get a lot of national coverage and we get a lot of local and what they call hyper-local coverage, but there's this huge vacuum, there's this huge hole in the middle of good capital coverage and particularly investigative journalism. So, you know, you get a lot of coverage when a big bill like Right to Life or something where a lot of people are interested, and that's really great. But what you don't get is the kind of bread and butter reporting behind the scenes, the influence of money in politics. KQED has been spending more time on this recently, which is great, but the role of lobbyists, you know, the role of a special interest in really driving legislation. And so that's really a huge hole, and it's just kind of a scramble to keep up with the bills as they move through the legislature, but not kind of the larger forces at work that are really quite frightening.
Well, and when you get together with your editorial team at the San Jose Merc, how do you all decide how to cover all of these bills? Which ones deserve their own piece, background, the money that was put into influencing the decisions behind these bills?
We try to do that whenever we can. I'm an investigative reporter, and I'm kind of I work kind of on specific issues and not necessarily on the daily coverage. But I will tell you, just from the beat social services and child welfare that I'm most familiar with, I focused on the bills related to my current project, but there are a lot of foster care bills actually that passed this year that I didn't really receive any coverage anywhere. There was a major overhaul of group homes in California that the state and advocates have been working on for years. There was a bill passed about parenting foster teens. And this is really what goes by the wayside. The demographics that do not have the lobby and the voice in Sacramento and their issues just get lost, even when the bills pass.
Right. Well, and the foster children that you write about definitely do not have a voice. And currently there are 62,000 foster children in the state of California?
Somewhere along those lines. And I will just point out that at one point we wrote in a recent story that the foster youth testifying recently for the bills that I wrote about were getting $10 a day meal stipends at a time when the lobbyists for the medical industry who were pushing against some of the bills that would better protect them were receiving $12,000 a day.
A day?
To lobby for their issues in general, but including these bills. So you see the contrast right there. And yet, in this case, the little guys won.
Oh, wow. Well, can you elaborate on that $10,000 amount or $12,000 amount?
Right.
How does that break down? Who's funding that?
So we're a little ahead of ourselves, but there was—so three bills were
passed and signed by Governor Brown to better protect foster youth from the excessive use of these psychiatric drugs. One bill was beat back at the last minute by lobbyists for physicians and for group homes. And that bill is now going to be reactivated in January. It's on what they call a two-year track. So it still has some hope. But this was the most aggressive curb that was being proposed. It was really the bill with most teeth, and it did not get signed into law. This bill, there's varying opinion on this. However, the lobbyists who were pushing against the bill, particularly at the last minute, in combination, these medical groups, we tallied up, we're getting $12,000 a day almost to lobby on these and other issues.
And these medical groups are with?
The California Medical Association, the California Psychiatric Association, the Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatrists, and the Alliance representing group home owners of private facilities.
Karen DeSaw is an award-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Last year, the San Jose Merc published her multi-part series on the alarming use of psychiatric medications among youth in California's foster system. Go to our website, and when you get a chance today, there's an amazing half-hour, 40-minute documentary that pulls all of this information together and really gives a voice to the foster youth who are dealing with this. An investigation found that 1 out of 4 adolescents in California's foster care system is receiving these drugs. We're also joined by Brian Lubitz, editor of Calitix.com. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or by going to yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about food waste. According to the World Research Institute, nearly $1 trillion worth of food is wasted every year. The average American wastes 10 times as much food as the average Southeast Asian, and that is up 50% from the 1970s. So what explains this, and what is being done to seriously tackle this issue? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. How are you keeping track of all of the bills that Governor Jerry Brown signed? He signed hundreds. He also vetoed a lot. Sometimes that's just as important as the bills that he signed. But these bills affect so many issues. Sexual education, drug use, foster care, protections, privacy, equal pay for women, guns, renewable energy, voting, and the right to die. Where are you seeing good reporting about these very important bills that have been signed? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Brian Lubitz, editor of Calitix.com, California's progressive news blog. Karen DeSaw is an award-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. And Karen, the piece that was published last week that exposed the alarming use of psychiatric medications among youth in California's foster system was a massive undertaking. You and photographer Dai Sagano interviewed more than 175 people, including dozens of current and former foster youth who were frequently moved and heavily medicated by the system that really struggles to manage their complicated childhood. So many of these children have gone through major, major trauma. Talk a little bit about how you first decided to tackle this issue.
So the series published last year, actually. Last week, we kind of had this exciting culmination of the reporting, which was Jerry Brown signing these three laws, which were inspired by the series. We looked at this alarming use of really heavy-duty psychiatric drugs. So psychotropic medications are everything from your run-of-the-mill ADD drugs, Ritalin, Adderall, Strattera, those some of the more common attention deficit medications, to the far more severe antipsychotics and mood stabilizers. And more than half of the medicated kids in foster care are on these drugs, the antipsychotics and drugs that are really designed for adults with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and mostly not approved for use in children. And they cause terrible side effects, morbid obesity, diabetes, tremors, kids sleeping through school. And so this is kind of something that, on top of all these foster kids are struggling with and suffering through, has not really been given enough redress.
And again, 62,000 foster children in California. How did your investigation travel to Sacramento? At what point did you start hearing from politicians?
We heard from politicians the moment the stories were posted to the website. The very first was Ted Lieu, who was then still in the state legislature, and he vowed a California Medical Board investigation because he was at that time chair of the committee overseeing the medical board. Jim Bell, state senator, Holly Mitchell, state senator, Bill Monning, state senator, and others immediately introduced this legislation. Four bills worked their way through both houses this this past year, and as I said, three were signed, and one on the back burner for now.
And Brian Lubitz, this really speaks to the power of investigative journalism.
It does, and when there is that in journalism, when there is that those resources dedicated to it, which is, you know, as we've seen, especially here in San Francisco, there's a decreasing level of investment in local reporting and statewide reporting. But when there is that level of reporting, it really breaks through the noise.
Right, and it can bring about major changes. I mean, on the ground, Karen, how are these bills going to affect these children that have already been affected by these drugs?
Right. So the bills are really broad in scope, and they do different things. They're really designed to be a package of bills. And I want to say at the outset that one of the main reasons this legislation was successful is because, in addition to the stories, the National Center for Youth Law and a couple of very, very dedicated attorneys and health policy analysts over there worked incredibly hard. So it was kind of a combination. But the bills would empower public health nurses to be more involved in monitoring the medication of foster children. All caregivers, attorneys, judges, and social workers would be trained on the effects and the side effects and what to look for. The juvenile court would get more information about how the kids were faring on the drugs. The juvenile court judges are the ones that approve them. And finally, group homes where kids are most medicated would be cracked down on by the state if they were allowing excessive medicating to go on. And some of these group homes, the vast majority, if not all of the kids, are on meds and multiple meds to just sedate them, keep difficult kids basically zombie-like and sleeping through their days.
When this piece was published, how did other California or even national media outlets respond?
Really well. And actually, I have to say, I really appreciate my partners and colleagues in radio, public radio, for specifically. We've been on NPR, NPR affiliates, KQED, KLW repeatedly has paid attention to this story. And it really feels important that at a certain point, we can't all be competitors. Hmm. We have to share each other's work. And so I'm really glad you guys are having me on. I know this is an issue that a lot of people really care about. And I appreciate the chance to talk about it. Not in a braggy way, because that's what it feels like sometimes. But look, I really feel that I'm the humble mouthpiece for these young people. That the power of this series, more than any advocates or any journalism, was the kids' voices. These kids, that we call them kids, they're young adults, but they were kids when they experienced these. And the power of our piece, our video, and our reporting was the young people who had the courage and the bravery to speak about these very, very disturbing and really humiliating experiences they had being doped up. So they are the ones that deserve all the credit, not Jerry Brown.
Well, and also 62,000 foster kids in the state of California, massive state. How have those numbers increased over the last couple decades? I mean, are we seeing major changes or is it a slow increase?
So if you look at the past decade, foster care numbers have gone down. Fewer kids are coming into the system. There's been more careful upfront social work so that people may not know this, but the vast majority of kids in foster care are not there directly because of physical or sexual abuse. They're usually in foster care because their parents are poor or on drugs or absent. So this is really an issue of is it really better to pull a lot of these kids out of their home, or is it better to do some front-end public health nursing and social work and work with the family to spare them the additional trauma of separation? So what happens, kids get pulled from parents who, as difficult as their home lives may have been, they still love. And then they have the wrenching experience in foster care, and then they get over-medicated, and it's a downward spiral from there.
What about that piece of the story? What are your thoughts about how reporters tackle that issue? Because, so you're saying that a lot of these kids are actually leave their homes because their parents can't afford to take care of them.
It's complicated, but for the most part, I mean, we have reported that 85% of kids in foster care are there due to neglect. Remember, it's abuse or neglect. So their parents were off binging on drugs, or they left them with inappropriate caregivers, or they were the victims of domestic violence. You know, a lot of times social workers pull kids if they get in the middle of a fight with mom and dad. So it's very... The foster children are in a way the victims of poverty and addiction and racism and historic economic inequality. So those are kind of the context setting situations for these kids.
Karen DeSaw is an award-winning investigative reporter with the San Jose Mercury News. Last year, the San Jose Merc published her multi-part series on the alarming use of psychiatric medications among youth in California's foster system. The series got a lot of attention in Sacramento, and Governor Brown just signed three bills affecting foster children. One would prevent the overprescription of these drugs, and I hope you can go watch the documentary that goes along with Karen's piece, a really powerful documentary in which foster children speak about how these drugs have affected them. And we're also joined by Brian Lubitz, editor of Calitix.com, California's progressive news blog. Today we're discussing media coverage of all of the bills. Well, not all of them. We couldn't do that. But some of the bills that Governor Brown signed, hundreds of really important bills. He also vetoed very important bills. So how are you getting information on this? What are your thoughts on this coverage? If you've seen a story that stands out for you, we'd love to hear from you. Toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Brian, what other bills maybe haven't received the attention they've deserved? So I saw so much coverage about the bill that will allow terminally ill patients to take their own lives. I mean, that's been receiving a lot of coverage over the last couple of years. And then SB 350 requires the state to generate half of its electricity from renewable sources by 2030. The state will also have to double energy efficiency in homes, offices, and factories. There are a couple of drought bills. AB 606 requires state agencies to modernize their irrigation systems. Another one prohibits cities and counties from enacting rules that ban the installation of drought-tolerant landscaping at residential properties. Any other bills you'd like to talk about that affects the environment?
Well, certainly there are a series of environment. One of the other ones that was important was a divestment from coal property, coal investments, which sort of has been a growing trend among sort of university students and sort of bubbled up. So that's a great grassroots to legislation story. In terms of other legislation, which I think is really important and maybe didn't get the coverage it should have, was SB 4 by Senator Lara down in near LA, which expands Medi-Cal to undocumented children. The bill was originally supposed to go for all undocumented immigrants to be allowed a Medi-Cal if they're eligible. But this is sort of a baby step to increasing health insurance coverage for all Californians.
And any others affecting health care and coverage?
Well, the other one, which sort of is tangentially related to healthcare, which I think is really important, was the one you vaguely referenced earlier, which was about crisis pregnancy centers, the so-called crisis pregnancy centers.
Right.
Which this legislation would crack down and require these centers, which are sort of confusing to the outside. So if you walk into these so-called clinics, they appear like they are actually clinics for women, but what they actually are is propaganda centers where they distribute a lot of just basically wrong information to women who are dealing in difficult situations in the first place, and then they're getting this, you know, just completely wrong scientific information about abortion, about choice, and about their options from at that point.
So there are 300 crisis pregnancy centers in California, and last year, NARAL Pro-Choice California sent undercover investigators to some of these offices and found that they strategically misinform and deceive pregnant women, always with the same message, bring the pregnancy to term. So AB 775 would require these centers the centers that discourage women from getting abortions to provide information about abortions and birth control. And three crisis pregnancy centers have already filed a lawsuit to block this measure.
Right. I mean, it was going to be litigated no matter what. I think what the legislature did well this time and with Governor Brown was work with Attorney General Harris's office to make sure to strengthen the bill as much as possible to respect the Constitution while at the same time directing, really making possible women to get correct information.
And RH Reality Check has been doing really good coverage on that. And then a separate bill, AB 329, will make the state's sex education the most comprehensive in the country. Sexual health classes will be mandatory for public school students in grades 7 through 12. And we've been talking about doing a show on that pretty soon. What else stands out for you? There was an important privacy bill, SB 178. This didn't get that much attention. The Electronic Frontier Foundation put out an alert about this. It requires law enforcement to obtain a warrant for digital records, including emails and texts, as well as a user's geographical location. Privacy advocates say that this was a long time coming because the state's privacy laws have not been updated since the 1980s. Have you been following this one, Brian?
Well, I mean, the problem, of course, is that when you legislate for technology, as soon as it passes, it's already obsolete. And one of the things which has, with the growth of the iPhone and other smartphones, is you see that those systems are constantly tracking your location. So if you, especially, if you have, those Google services, you can go look on the internet and it will show you exactly where you've been every moment of your day. Which I suppose could be kind of scary, depending on who you are. You obviously have control over it, and some people like that ability to, sort of have those options. But at the same time, that information is available to the police, whether you are correctly or incorrectly targeted for an investigation. So those records need to be considered part of your daily records and shouldn't be just readily accessible.
And so privacy advocates are cheering that bill. Another one that's important, Karen, SB 358 bars employers from paying women less than men when they do substantially similar work. It makes it unlawful for employers to prohibit workers from talking about their own wages or the wages of coworkers, asking, say, Tom, what do you make? I do the same job as you, and I'd like to know what you make. And so it bars employers from retaliating against or discriminating against employees who seek out the pay disparity information. And so I read a lot of stories about all these laws. The one thing that's missing from a lot of the reporting is how these laws will actually be enforced and how they play out on the ground. So, for example, the foster care bills that were signed, how will these bills and these new laws actually be enforced? And how do you report on that?
Well, that's really important because, you know, these are only as important as they are in effect. And so I think one of the most important features of the foster care psychotropics bills is that they're going to now keep data. So, like, for instance, we had to spend almost a year fighting to get the basic public records that allowed us to do the analysis of just how many kids were medicated while in foster care. And this was completely de-identified data. So it was publicly available. We weren't looking to expose the privacy of any particular youth. These laws will now track and produce regular reports on kids' medication records and whether they also received counseling services in addition or instead of pharmaceuticals. And this information will be available to people making decisions. So some of these things, in terms of follow-up, someone needs to then go back and look, okay, the data are out there. What does it say? What is it going to say in a year? And at least on this issue at the Mercury News, we're not done with this issue, and we're going to continue to look at this.
And Brian, this is why reporting and investigative reporting is so important, because most of the articles did report that these new laws go into effect mostly in January, but very few of these articles talked about how these laws will be implemented.
Right. I mean, I think that's important. And if you look at even, you know, sites like mine, it's hard to keep up with anything that's not regularly covered.
Right.
And, you know, unless you're actually, you know, on the ground working in those institutions, it's why the growth of, you know, Facebook and blogs are so important, that it's important for people who are involved in day-to-day operations like the foster system and like, you know, environmental regulations in California speak up about it. And that, you know, all those organizations can push their messages out directly through social media.
It speaks to the importance of organizations and, you know, reporters' relationships with organizations. So, for example, this equal pay law for women was advocated by equal rights advocates, and I'm sure they're going to be in touch with women on the ground who are now trying to figure out what their colleagues make, and then if there's retaliation, the organization will compile it and then send it to reporters. So that's usually how it works now, because it's hard to keep track of all of this with so few reporters.
Right, and it has to be, unfortunately. You know, the press release is growing in importance, that, you know, reporters who are on a beat will get, you know, hundreds of press releases. And when they get one that's sort of what they deem as newsworthy, I mean, it's hard to do much more than, an edit of those to get into the papers. So I think it's important that those organizations do a good job of getting that information out. But I also think reporters have to look critically at all those press releases as well.
And just a couple other bills. SB 707 prohibits people with concealed weapon permits from carrying firearms on school and college campuses. People who have concealed carry permits would be allowed to carry firearms within 1,000 feet of a public or private K-12 school, but not on the grounds. Gun owners groups say they plan to challenge that law. AB 30 will prevent public schools from using the Redskins name for sports teams and mascots. Four California schools currently have teams or mascots called the Redskins. And another education bill, SB 172, suspends California's high school exit exam for 3 years to allow officials to prepare a new exam aligned with the Common Core standards. This bill is really important for 32,000 students who didn't pass the exam dating back to 2004, and they will now receive diplomas as they completed all their graduation requirements. There was a good piece, I think the LA Times, quoting a lot of these students saying they never got their diploma and now they finally have it and they can move on with their lives. So that was a really, really, really important one. Any others, Karen, that you saw that you want to talk about?
Well, you talked about laws that didn't either got vetoed or in this case didn't reach the governor's desk. So since you have me on to talk about the psychotropics issue, I will just mention that SB 253, which was introduced by Senator Bill Mauning of Carmel, who, coincidentally was working very hard on his right to die bill. But also on this one, this did not reach the governor's desk, although it was getting unanimous votes in both houses. This bill would have been the strongest of the foster care package. It would have required that doctors who need to get their prescriptions approved by the juvenile court for foster children prove and justify that the medications were the least invasive treatment necessary, that they had tried other types of therapies. It would have strengthened kids' right to refuse the medications. A lot of these kids feel coerced and even forced. A lot of them in group homes are punished when they don't take the drugs, even though they make them feel terrible. And it would have allow judges to get second medical opinion, so that if doctors were prescribing to kids under five, for instance, or were prescribing multiple meds or meds in dangerous combinations, the judges would have had the resources and authority to ask for second medical opinions before they approve them. So that bill, SB 253, will supposedly come back to the legislature next year, but did not make it to the governor's desk this year.
And we talked about this earlier, but who were the major opponents of that bill?
So they will not call themselves opponents, but I do know that behind the scenes there was a lot of lobbying by the doctors groups and by the group home representatives. However, I think there was also concern by the Brown administration that was voiced to the author of this bill that there were some details that needed sorting out for kids in rural counties who don't have access to psychiatrists and who would pay for the second medical opinion. So apparently these are going to get sorted out and this bill will come back next year.
We have an email from Marie. Having worked in acute psychiatry as a nurse for more than 30 years, I have seen the abuse in the use of medications on adults and also the therapeutic use of those medications. Knowing and having witnessed the side effects of the more modern antipsychotics used on adults, I am appalled that they are used on children. Thank you for bringing this huge misuse to the light. And what is next for this investigation, Karen?
So without revealing too much, we've requested more data from the State Department of Healthcare Services, and we have published before the information that we are now looking at the prescribers of these medications who, in one part of our series, we identified as more likely to be receiving more money from drug companies in terms of meals, travel, research money, gifts, consulting money than your average California doctor. So we're going to take a closer look at that.
Are you planning to name names?
Yes, we are.
Well, we will definitely have you back when that is published. And so the San Jose Merc is continuing to support this investigation.
Absolutely. My people at the Mercury News are very, very committed. And my colleague, Dai Sagano, and I have been working on this now for almost 2 years.
Wow. Brian, we've got a couple minutes left. What other bills were vetoed that you would like to talk about?
Oh, one that I wrote about in Calisix was the bill 8465 by Assemblyman Hernandez, which would have banned mandatory arbitration in employment contracts, especially when new employees did not know about them, which would have been a good step forward for workers. One other thing which also came up, sort of somewhat related to the abuse of psychotropics, is the use of antibiotics in our farming system. And the governor signed, I believe it's SB 27 or 72, which would ban the use of human antibiotics on animals without a veterinarian's prescription, which had, in the past, there had been just basically if a farmer felt that there was concern about an animal, he would just preventively use antibiotics, which would then get into our food supply, increasing antibiotic resistance, which is a major problem in healthcare these days.
And, Brian, what are you working on right now?
Well, I mean, I'll continue to sort of follow up on various bills and sort through some of them and see which ones are we should call out and look for more information on.
And Calitix.com, you've been doing this for quite a while. What gap do you see? What gap are you filling? I mean, what are your thoughts on where you fit in the California media landscape?
Right. Well, you know, I started the site in 2005, so it's been a while. I still think it's probably more true than it was in 2005 that there is still that dearth of coverage on state level issues. Mm. So, you know, there are some resources from the big, a couple big newspapers in the state, but you know, they only have so many resources to cover all these issues. And you know, I try to sort of empower other people to encourage them to either post in Calitix or to go directly to people who would be interested in these. There obviously are a lot of issues that can be dealt with at the state level.
Brian Lubitz is the editor of Calitix.com, and Karen DeSaw is an award-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And I know we mentioned so many bills. I've got a nice list, and I will put it on KALW's Facebook page. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.